I caught this morning, morning's minion, kingdom of daylight's dauphin, dapple dawn-drawn falcon, in his riding of the rolling level underneath him steady air, and striding high there, how he rung upon the rein of a wimpling wing in his ecstasy. Then off forth on swing, as a skate's heel sweeps smooth on a bow bend, the hurl and gliding rebuffed the big wind. My heart in hiding stirred for a bird, the achiever of, the mastery of the thing. Brute beauty and valor and act, oh, air, pride, plume, here buckle, and the fire that breaks from thee then, a billion times told lovelier, more dangerous, O my chevalier. No wonder of it, sheer plod makes plough down sillion shine, and blue bleak embers, ah, my dear, fall, gall themselves, and gash gold vermilion. The radical question confronting anyone who presumes to speak intimately and knowledgeably about any poem is this, and I believe it to be recurrent, intractable, insoluble. Do you, in taking such an approach, focus the attention of a listener of goodwill, or do you dissipate it? I don't have an answer to my own question, but I feel constrained to ask the unanswerable question each time that I feel myself under some sort of obligation to take an analytical approach to any poem that I would happily entrust myself to without question, and which in turn I wish to entrust to the vigilant care of any reader of intelligent goodwill. This poem is an Italianate or Miltonic sonnet, the octave rhyming ABBA, ABBA, and the sestet rhyming CDC, DCD. If you are of the party that holds rhyme to be determined by the final syllable alone, then you might claim that the octave rhymes AAA, AAA. But on this I find myself more cavalier than roundhead, and declare the pattern to be king riding, striding, wing, swing, hiding, gliding, thing. Riding, striding, hiding, and gliding are either verbal substantives or participial adjectives, and you have to pick one here. So I plump for participial adjectives, which one could enlarge on by saying that they commit you or condemn you to a kind of unresolved present tense. And that in this case, the fact that each of the eight lines of the octave ends in ing heightens the sense that conventional grammar and syntax and even euphony are in some way being made to appear subject to some kind of eccentric constraint beyond their immediate remit. If one's first reaction is just, and it may not be, is it because the poet believes himself to be vaticized beyond the reach of commonplace propriety, or because he is such a strange kind of semantic moralist that he expects one to pick up an arrestingly ethical challenge from an unexplained sequence of participial adjectives. The author's notes tell us that the sonnet is in falling paeonic rhythm, sprung and outriding, a description which even classical scholars would find difficult to transpose from the meters and rhythms of, say, Aeschylus to those of a late 19th century poem written in English, a poetic tradition based on radically different concepts of meter, rhythm, and stress. A Greek paeon is a metrical unit of four syllables, one of which is stressed. The positioning of the stressed, the unstressed syllables can have four permutations, which again doesn't help us very much. I don't believe for one moment that the author of this sonnet adopts such minutiae of technique because he wishes to embarrass the critical faculties of his reader. A much lonelier kind of agon engages his attention. How to articulate moods, responses, in this case, responses to nature and to natural beauty, that are so changeable, that presuppose and imply such idiosyncratic rapport and dislocation as to render them scarcely manageable by the standard rhetorical structures of Victorian poetry. Gerard Hopkins, who wrote this poem, took a double first in classics at Balliol and had available to him a field of intelligence concerning the connectives between feeling and utterance that are not readily available to those of us who do not have Greek and Latin so immediately at our fingertips. I stress the word feeling because Gerard Hopkins was, in that respect at least, a characteristic intellectual of the Victorian period. He found it necessary to be in earnest with and about things. Kenneth Haynes has written that earnestness may be the most important word in Hopkins's criticism. Indeed, Hopkins wrote of Aeschylus that he manifested earnestness of spirit. The earnestness in this sonnet drives in two not wholly compatible directions. There is the earnestness of the ornithologist, endeavoring to capture mimetically and with as accurate a mimesis as he can contrive the characteristic movements of a particular bird. And there is the earnestness of a Roman Catholic candidate for the priesthood, who finds the demandingness of his faith and his vocation, its testingness, sometimes radically at odds with sensuous responsiveness. However graceful the bird, it is not in a state of grace. However murderous its activities towards field mice, it will never incur damnation. The poem's title, as you know, is The Wind Hover. The wind hover is the kestrel, Falco tinunculus, the lovely English name, certainly lovelier than the alternative name, windfucker, alludes to the bird's exceptional skill in hovering in a wind, the tautology I find unavoidable. The motto, or epigraph, or dedication to Christ our Lord was not added until 1884, almost 7 years after the poem's completion. Its presence here is the equivalent in Hopkins to what in a poet who was not a Jesuit ordinand might have read to John and Susan, or to Dr. John Prendergast with admiration and respect. The poet is offering up to Christ the best that he has. His dedication to Christ our Lord has much in common with the motto of the society to which he belonged, Ad Maiorem Dei Gloriam. Whatever the sonnet is or may be, it is not an allegory of Christ's earthly ministry. It is a poem of perceiving, and then it is a poem about qualitative differences between degrees of perception. It is written as it is, and as the preponderance of Hopkins's finest poems are written, because of the poet's aversion from what he termed the Parnassian effect in poetry. Parnassian, he said, is the language of poetry draping prose thought. Parnassian is the language of poetry draping prose thought. And he believed this to be a vice into which even the finest poets, and he named Wordsworth, into which even the finest poets fall when they are performing mere poetic task work. There is some task work, or what to us would seem task work, among Hopkins's own poems. For instance, there is a poem called The Silver Jubilee to James, first Bishop of Shrewsbury, on the 25th year of his episcopate, July the 28th, 1876. And there is a lyric called What Shall I Do for the Land That Bred Me? A late set of verses, so late that it surprises some people, a late set of verses set to a melody composed by himself. An attempt, as he said, to mark the 20th anniversary of his having enrolled as a soldier of Christ, that is to say, having entered the Jesuit novitiate, an effort which he tried to combine with the ambition to write, as he said, a patriotic song for soldiers. Heaven knows it is needed. But what is truly remarkable about these otherwise unremarkable pieces is the manner in which he attempts to give sheer plod of the dutiful its own inscape and instress. In the marching song, he relied, he said, on the tune composed by himself, very flowing and spirited, he called it. Wherever and whenever one finds oneself in a relationship with a poem by Hopkins, the factor that has to be negotiated one way or another is the question of naivety. Where Parnassian is for him a bad word, enthusiasm is a good word. He described retrospectively his sonnet, Hurrahing in Harvest, as the outcome of half an hour of extreme enthusiasm as I walked home alone one day from fishing in the Elwy. He bewildered Coventry Patmore and subsequently myself by declaring that his most complexly notated poems were spontaneously uttered. How such modes, or at least some of them, as for example your alliterations, come to be the spontaneous expression of your poetical feeling, I cannot understand, and I do not think I ever shall. At the same time, I would say that Patmore's own phrasing in that protest may give some indication as to why Hopkins felt it necessary to write as he did. Patmore's phrase, the spontaneous expression of your poetical feeling, the spontaneous expression of your poetical feeling, does seem to suggest that Patmore presupposes a sort of time lag between a sensory reaction to which you can legitimately apply such a restrictive term as poetical feeling, and the conversion of it into appropriate poetical utterance. That is to say that Patmore seems to speak for the great body of opinion against which Hopkins was writing, that there is something magically hived off from feeling, and it is called poetical feeling, and that you, as it were, then arrange the poetical feeling into appropriate terminology. Where Hopkins differs from his contemporaries, I would say, is in his excision of any sense of hiatus between sensation and utterance, and in his abandonment of the kinds of word usage that would seem to imply that once having been uttered, an emotive utterance is thereby fixed. One still hears it said from time to time that Hopkins, like Milton, whom he greatly admired, wrote against the English language. That he wrote against the English language. In considering the correctness or otherwise of this view, we should first ask what against the language means to us as a phrase. If we think first, and we may well do, of some natural medium such as wood and of those who work in it, the locution against thee will necessarily seem to continue naturally into against the grain of, with the further implication that only a carpenter or a joiner who was A, inept, B, contrary, an old cuss to the point of self-destructiveness, would find himself or herself working or choosing to work against the grain of the natural medium. If, however, we think first or even secondly of against the stream, we ought not immediately infer ineptitude or even mere willfulness. Because we have read 17th century writers such as Clarendon and his tribute to the memory of those few who out of duty and conscience have opposed and resisted the torrent. He's writing of the Civil War as a constitutional royalist. The memory of those few who out of duty and conscience have opposed and resisted the torrent. Or because we have read a romantic platonic radical Tory, S.T. Coleridge, with his insistence that self-experience is most clearly realized by the process of winning one's way up against the stream. And added to that, his observation that human nature itself fights up against the willful resignation of intellect, that human nature itself fights up against the willful resignation of intellect, or because we admire a 19th century Oxford liberal, T.H. Green, and his dictum that it may very well happen that the desire which affects a man most strongly is the one which he decides on resisting, we may with some reason suppose that the construction against the is ethically preferable to willful resignation of intellect and all that that phrase implies. Or if we consider that a bird will take off against the wind to get more purchase upon the air, it may well strike us that what we airily call lyric flight, is itself best engineered in opposition to some current or pressure. We speak, of course, of a bird taking off into the wind. If we substitute in this matter of language into for against, and think of a poet writing into the language, we find that we have converted the negative, pejorative implications of sullen hostility into a form of reciprocity, of radical involvement. Now, it has been increasingly the care and concern of Milton scholars over the last 50 years to demonstrate how he writes into the language rather than against it. The genius of Shakespeare is that he writes into the language, and the shortcoming of late 16th century appraisal of Shakespeare, and there wasn't much of it, is that Elizabethan criticism, with the exception of Philip Sidney, did not possess a language perception capable of describing what it was that Shakespeare did. Sidney could have done it, but he died too soon. Or if Thomas Nash had turned his thoughts towards theatre criticism, things might have looked up. But he didn't, and he died far too young. Even in what I've said so far, it would be perfectly reasonable of you if you were to discern elements of self-contradiction, both in what I say of Hopkins and in what Hopkins says of himself. Let us briefly review the basics. Here is a poet who in 1879 writes to Robert Bridges, "Then again I have of myself made verse so laborious. Then again I have of myself made verse so laborious." Now, this is the same poet who the previous year had described, as we have already noted, the sonnet Hurrahing in Harvest as the outcome of half an hour of extreme enthusiasm as I walked home alone one day after fishing in the Elwy, and who some years later in 1885 would write to Bridges of four sonnets that, and I quote, "came like inspirations, unbidden and against my will." There is some strange hiatus here. But in saying that, of course, I am not saying that it detracts from what Hopkins is doing. I am saying that it exists. And it is one of the many fascinations that go into our attempt to rightly evaluate the things that he was for or the things that he was up against in the poetic language and attitudes of his time. To understand the pitch of Hopkins's creative process, we must be able to conceive of a state of attention at once spontaneous and exacting. At once spontaneous and exacting, the one does not cancel out the other. There is some mutuality between the antithetical powers, which at his best make him such an extraordinary writer. Of course, a very reasonable kind of caveat, which I don't want to delay over, would be that when you say that a poem is the outcome of half an hour of extreme enthusiasm, you're not necessarily suggesting that the poem was composed in half an hour. It was the extreme enthusiasm that lasted half an hour. But that's a kind of marginal flea bite of an attempt to vindicate. If I couldn't vindicate him on other grounds, I wouldn't want to vindicate him on that. Nor are subsequent revisions and second thoughts necessarily precluded, as we have seen to be the case with the addition of the dedication to Christ our Lord several years later than the poem's actual composition. The addition of the words to Christ our Lord is an instance of the dogmatic Catholic Hopkins making doubly sure that non-dogmatists do not misread the Windhover as a piece of Swinburnian paganism. His own sensuousness troubled him deeply because he knew, and he expressed his anxiety, he knew how finely the line could be drawn between sensuousness and sensuality. And I believe that he would have assented to the recent observation by the American choreographer Mark Morris, "I'm not interested in self-expression, but in expressiveness. I'm not interested in self-expression, but in expressiveness." The warp in Keats's genius troubled him, even though he valued his great gifts and defended him against the condescensions of Coventry Patmore. He understood the Shakespearean element in Keats to be his ability to write into the language. And he comes up with this marvelous sentence. Patmore had been saying what a horrible little sensualist Keats is. And Hopkins has to say, "Well, yes, I see what you mean." But then he adds, he would find his way right at last to the true functions of his mind. He would find his way right at last to the true functions of his mind. It's a marvelous way of putting it, for what, after all, is this capacity of writing into the language if it is not a particular poet's gift of finding her way through the employment of language to the true functions of her mind? Compare Emily Dickinson, who does find her way to the true functions of her mind, with Emily Bronte, who doesn't quite. I mean Emily Bronte the poet, not Emily Bronte the author of Wuthering Heights. Emily Bronte the poet does not quite find her way. But as I said, he does accept, and not merely for politeness's sake, Patmore's objections up to a point. "Yes," he says, "yes, it is impossible not to feel with weariness how his verse is at every turn abandoning itself to an unmanly and enervating luxury. I mean, in that unmanly, there again you get, you know, the historical context, as you do in masculine and feminine rhymes. Feminine rhymes supposedly weaker than masculine. It's impossible not to feel with weariness how his verse is at every turn abandoning itself to an unmanly and enervating luxury. That phrase, how his verse at every turn, greatly interests me as an instance of Hopkins's critical and self-critical idioms. Outside this immediate context of Hopkins's phrase, the phrase at every turn is a rhetorical cliché, no better than other rhetorical clichés such as ever and anon, which are pompous substitutes for always and everywhere. But there is no English poetry more full of turns than is Hopkins's, and there is in Hopkins no individual poem more full of turns than is the Windhover, and each turn in this poem is a critical moment. It is critical that Hopkins, the excellent pre-Raphaelite draftsman and Ruskinian annotator of natural forms, should be accurate in his descriptions of the kestrel's muscular reflexes. And it is critical that the student of church dogmatics should not lead either himself or a reader at some future date astray at some point of detail concerning the destiny of the individual Christian soul. And for Christian, this being Hopkins, one has to read Catholic. Everyone knows what Hopkins wrote when he presented the new prosody, as he called it, to Robert Bridges. Why do I employ sprung rhythm at all? He asks rhetorically. Because it is nearest to the rhythm of prose, that is, the native and natural rhythm of speech, the least forced, the most rhetorical and emphatic of all possible rhythms, combining, as it seems to me, opposite and, one would have thought, incompatible excellences. Incompatible excellences. That is, markedness of rhythm, rhythm's self, and naturalness of expression. How to work oxymoronically or paradoxically is Hopkins' concern. How you write to such a pitch of artificial organization that the result is the most strikingly natural expression that you can encounter in poetry of the Victorian period. Artificiality creates naturalness. If only that were better understood at the present time. Artificiality creates naturalness. Naturalness, all too easily, can be seen as mimetic artificiality. My only gloss on what Hopkins said would be to add that when we read the words markedness and naturalness, we associate each with a sense of earnestness, in earnestness, not gravity, but the being in earnest with your subject, reality. Turns of phrase which to us sound indelibly Victorian, for the perfectly good reason that Hopkins was indelibly Victorian. We see here, too, that even in his expository prose style, Hopkins works to create a grammar that can appear naturally in earnest, while handling concepts that one would have supposed, and that he presupposes we will have supposed, to be incompatible excellences. He explained to his friend Canon Dixon that the word sprung, which I use for this rhythm, means something like abrupt, and applies by rights only, where one stress follows another running, without syllable between. Taking Hopkins's equation of sprung with abrupt, we can see that in the Windhover, for example, this basic effect of sprung rhythm is achieved in line 5 with off, off, fourth, where he has three stressed words without intervening syllable, and in line 12, where in sheer plod, he has two stressed words without an intervening syllable. And I call to mind in this connection a turn of phrase from another of his sonnets, Henry Purcell, composed 2 years later than the Windhover. This is the line of own of abrupt self, there so thrusts on, so throngs the ear. Here the word abrupt seeks to alert us to the distinctive quality of Purcell's music. And the word is itself sprung against the immediately following stressed word self, without syllable coming between. I recall that when many years ago, and this is in a way the heart of what I want to say. I recall that when many years ago I first noticed that the word abrupt is applied by Hopkins to a particular form of idiosyncratic creative gift in a human being, as well as to a particular idiosyncratic type of metric. So there is an abrupt meter and there is an abrupt self. It struck me that I had myself moved abruptly forward in the understanding of exactly how it is that Hopkins sees intent and utterance as all of a piece in the formation of a poetry of ideas. I mean that in his poetry at its most acute, a proposition is not hindered by its having to wait around while it is translated into an appropriate poetic verbiage. The inflections of the idea are in an immediate sense the inflections of the grammatical line, or as he himself put it more simply and more memorably in his anticipation of the ways in which Keats's genius would have developed had he lived, he would find his way right at last to the true functions of his mind. And perhaps I may be allowed to interpolate here a further recollection that what many of us responded to 60, 65 years ago in F.R. Leavis's essay on Keats in Revaluation was his ability to demonstrate that in the odes, Keats was succeeding against all the obstacles set in his way by polite taste in finding his way to the true functions of his poetic mind. So let me repeat, if there is a single point at which in my reading of the matter, Hopkins's twin intuitions about rhythmic stress and stress of self come together, it is in these two sprung words, abrupt self, of the Purcell sonnet. And those members of the present audience who came to my lecture last term will have had no need of my prompting to see how words I used then, monumentality and bidding, also by Hopkins, monumentality and bidding, and abrupt and to the true function of his mind, which I'm emphasizing in this lecture, belong together in the same keeping, as Hopkins would say. It's likely that what Hopkins admired in Purcell, that which he sought to emulate, insofar as a poet can emulate a composer, is Purcell's in earnestness with the subject, a technical in earnestness with the subject, a quality that does not eschew humor, and that is not wholly synonymous with gravity or solemnity, some quality that Hopkins in a letter to Bridges catches in a spade as a spade kind of phrase. Bridges had said and written, saying, as most many of Hopkins' friends, what do you mean? What do you mean? And Hopkins replied with simultaneously good-humoured irascibility, "My sonnet means Purcell's music is none of your damned subjective rot, so to speak. My sonnet means Purcell's music is none of your damned subjective rot, so to speak." This is in essence what the Windhover and some other of Hopkins' sonnets mean, if I may put it so crudely. This enthusiasm, it seems to say, this ecstasy, this making of poems is finally none of your damned subjective rot. Hopkins is in earnest with the kestrel, with predatory and God-embodying nature, with the reality of being in apposition and opposition to appearances of being. He is also in earnest with church dogmatics and with the salvation of his own soul. The poet who writes, "My heart in hiding stirred for a bird, the achiever of the mastery of the thing," is also and indivisibly the drudging Jesuit scholastic. There is, in fact, a not entirely attractive letter written on the last day of 1867, some 14 months after his reception into the Roman Catholic Church, and some 9 months before his admission to the Jesuit novitiate. And the recipient of this not wholly attractive letter was a friend who was passing through a period of spiritual discomfort in the Church of England. In 1867, I mean, you would fall over people in the Broad who were all experiencing some difficulties with the spiritual life of the Church of England. But Hopkins writes to him unyieldingly and unsympathetically. "The place of presumption is where logic is indecisive. But if logic looks decisive, then what is it you're doing but to throw away that dogmatic ground for which you must always contend and without which your movement and your whole individual life are nothing? The place of presumption is where logic is indecisive. But if logic looks decisive, then what is it you are doing but to throw away that dogmatic ground for which you always must contend and without which your movement and your whole individual life are nothing?" And there is a harrowing letter to his father around the same time, 16th, 17th of October, 1866, just prior to his reception into the Catholic Church. Both his parents, high Anglicans, were appalled by his decision to convert. And he says to his father, "I am surprised you should say fancy and aesthetic tastes have led me to my present state of mind. These would be better satisfied in the Church of England, for bad taste is always meeting one in the accessories of Catholicism." Writing in 1938, the Hopkins editor Claude Collier Abbott said of the December 1867 letter to his troubled Anglican friend that it shows Hopkins as a violent and even impatient proselytizer, rather frightening in his narrow and dogmatic rightfulness. I cite this in the comment about fancy and aesthetic tastes in the letter to his father in order to stress the significance of scholastic logic and the insignificance of aesthetics in Hopkins' thinking, and as a warning to ourselves not to impose our aesthetics on poems such as the Windhover. Put slightly differently, I don't believe that the turns in the Windhover to which I referred earlier are some kind of psychological crisis caught on camera. I do not think that they are Hopkins's selfies. I believe that they are stages in doctrinal discourse, and that Hopkins is in command of them even before he begins his composition. I further suggest that if Hopkins had had real reasons to fear that he was so inept a moral theologian as to imperil his soul and undermine the teachings of the church by the mere writing of something so ultimately to be dispensed with as a poem, he would have stuck by his original decision to abandon the writing of poetry on entering the Jesuit novitiate. He had burnt his poetry manuscripts on May the 11th, 1868, 1 week after he had resolved to become a priest, and he resumed his writing of poems in late December 1875, having received, as he believed, an invitation from his superiors to do so. To view him as an ecstatic, solipsistic rhapsodist without reference to the solid grounding in Catholic dogmatics and the tactics of 19th century Catholic proselytizing is to fail to be in earnest oneself with the distinctive quality of his genius. The Wreck of the Deutschland ends with a prayer for the conversion of England. The Windhover is in the end a song of praise to the hidden life, the ascetic, self-abnegating, duty-bound, plodding, unglamorous, celibate life. No wonder of it, sheer plod makes plough down silly and shine, and blue-bleak embers, ah, my dear, fall, gall themselves, and gash gold vermilion. On March the 11th, 1877, at St. Bino's, the Jesuit theologate in North Wales, just 2 months before the Windhover was composed, Hopkins had to deliver a dominical, that is to say, an apprentice Sunday sermon, in the presence of his fellow student. He made them laugh prodigiously, though this had not been his intention. Despite the humiliating failure of his delivery, the sermon contains a number of beautiful things and also shows the distinctive quality of Hopkins' thought at the time that he wrote The Windhover. He observes that St. Philip, one of those present at the feeding of the multitude as recorded in St. John's Gospel, that he had a Greek name meaning fond of horses, Phil Hippos. Fond of horses, proud of his stud. Hopkins works the etymology into a theological point, observing that Christ would give him, that is to say, St. Philip, Christ would give him, instead of his contemplation of this world's studs and steeds and splendor, its chivalry and chariots and chargers, an eye to dwell on the glory of the kingdom of heaven. The theological antithesis of the March 1877 sermon is essentially the theological antithesis of the May 1877 poem, 2 months later. As Philip's attention is moved by Christ from the contemplation of chivalry and chariots and chargers to the glory of the kingdom of heaven, so the speaker's attention in the Windhover is moved from the kestrel as an emblem of the splendors of worldly hegemony, minion, kingdom, dauphin, beauty, valor, to the contemplation of the beauty of a spiritual hierarchy conveyed in the resplendent colors, possibly suggestive of sacrifice and of martyrdom, gold vermilion, traditionally esteemed a color of great price and estimation, associated here with something as humble as a coal fire, its apparently dead embers breaking open to reveal that they are not dead, one of the most commonplace perceptions of any inhabitant of the British Isles before the advent of central heating. It is not, as I understand the matter, that Hopkins in the Windhover is at first enthusiastic and then in a panic-stricken kind of way drops his enthusiasm. He converts the enthusiasm from the less to the more so. I take those last seven words from his major prose writings, his commentary on the Spiritual Exercises, largely composed in 1881-2, 4 to 5 years after the composition of the Windhover, but even so, still some 12 to 18 months before the words to Christ our Lord were added beneath the poem's title. The seven words that I've just quoted in isolation read in context as follows. God exercises his mastery and dominion over his creatures' wills in two ways, over the affective will by simply determining it so or so, as it is said, the heart of the king is in the Lord's hand to turn it which way he will, over the arbitrium, or power of pitch, by shifting the creature from one pitch contrary to God's will to another which is according to it, or from the less to the more so. The affective will is the essential self motivated by the feelings, swayed by emotions. The arbitrium is man's personality or individuality and places him on a level of individuality in some sense with God. The word arbitrium was not coined by Hopkins, but the definition I have just given you is his. The drama of the Windhover, putting it crudely, is the movement from affective will to arbitrium, that aspect of the speaker which is moved by the beauty of the kestrel's flight is the affective will, and its ecstatic response is the matter of the octave. That aspect of the speaker which turns to other and higher forms of beauty is the arbitrium. And this is celebrated in the sestet. In a further set of retreat notes made some 12 months later, Hopkins considers the power and the limitations of those creatures which are other than mankind. The heavens declare the glory of God. He is quoting the opening of Psalm 19 in the Anglican Psaltery. They glorify God, but they do not know it. The birds sing to him, the thunder speaks of his terror, the lion is like his strength, the sea is like his greatness, the honey like his sweetness. There's something like him, they make him known, they tell of him, they give him glory, but they do not know they do. They do not know him, they never can. They are brute things that only think of food or think of nothing. This then is poor praise, faint reverence, slight service, dull glory. Nevertheless, what they can, they always do. Brute beauty and valor and act, O air, pride, plume, here buckle. And the fire that breaks from thee then, a billion times told lovelier, more dangerous, O my chevalier. If Hopkins's retreat notes about shifting the creature from one pitch contrary to God's will to another which is according to it, or from the less to the more so, if these are a legitimate key to our understanding of this poem, then that neo-scholastic dispute among the exegetes as to whether the imperative buckle means abruptly give way or abruptly take upon oneself is largely resolved, since the pitch of each meaning is reciprocally sustained in the other. In changing from the less to the more so, from enthusiasm to holy enthusiasm, one abruptly surrenders so that one may abruptly take to oneself the whole armor of God, conceived, as is always the case with Hopkins, in terms of priestly obedience. More needs to be said, because the grammatical overtones at this point will not let me off so lightly. The imperative buckle, in this sense of abruptly give way, is commonly read as an imperative to the kestrel, as if he were saying, enough of your aerobatics, I must be about my master's business. And the thee of the phrase, and the fire that breaks from thee then, is seen as ambiguous in its deployment. Is thee a word referring to kestrel or Christ? If the stress is on thee, then it is Christ. If then carries the stress, it is the kestrel. As I understand it, the crux has to be resolved theologically before it is understood poetically. And this may be the one weakness in the poem, because all my argument over the past 4 years has been that the grammar of the poem decides the grammar of the belief. And here I am, in my pagan way, confronting a poem where inexorably, if you're in doubt, you say that the theology has to be considered. I don't know, I leave that as an open question. I am as confident as I can be that thee and the fire that breaks from thee then is Christ. And it is Christ who is my chevalier, not the kestrel, which in the sonnet's opening lines has been fawned upon as morning's minion, kingdom of daylight's dauphin. If Christ is my chevalier, then I am his vassal. And this is truly a better condition of being than being on display merely as next in line to a natural supremacy that finally does not know Christ. What you look hard at seems to look hard at you is a sentence that I came upon by chance in Hopkins's journal, written in early March 1871. Everything of value that I've ever found that I've come upon by chance. I am the last walking example of the marvels of serendipity. And I came upon that sentence by chance. Granted that I had decided to read Hopkins's journal, of course, which... what you look hard at seems to look hard at you. Hence the true and the false in stress of nature. I was taken with the words I chose for this lecture because they appear to give a much clearer and more forceful impression of in-stress than that given by the 1989 OED, which simply reads, rather unhelpfully in my opinion, in-stress, in the theories of Gerard Manley Hopkins, the force or energy which sustains an inscape. See quotes. One of those quotes is by W.A.M. Peters, who says that in-stress is that stress or energy of being by which all things are upheld and strive after continued existence. But then comes the concluding part of Hopkins's sentence, hence the true and the false in-stress of nature. Immediately alerting himself, because who else would he imagine reading his journal? Alerting himself to the potential betrayal at the heart of his own poetics. In the sentences immediately preceding this particular sentence, he had been beautifully describing in a Ruskinian fashion the patterning of clouds. And inevitably, I suppose, his concluding half-sentence puts one in mind of Hamlet and Polonius. Hamlet, do you see yonder cloud that's almost in shape of a camel? Polonius, by the mass, it is like a camel indeed. Hamlet, methinks it is like a weasel. It is backed like a weasel.
Or like a whale.
Very like a whale. Ultimately, I believe, Hopkins considers that language is yet another creature backed like a weasel. And in his commentaries on the spiritual exercises, is prepared to make a burnt offering of the two words of self-committing techne that lie closest to his heart. This song of Lucifer's, he says, this song of Lucifer's was a dwelling on his own beauty, an instressing of his own inscape. I know that had I ever written poetry of his powers, it is not the kind of radical creative abnegation that I could ever have made. I caught this morning's minion, kingdom of daylight's dauphin, dapple dawn-drawn falcon, in his riding of the rolling level underneath him steady air, and striding high there, how he rung upon the rein of a wimpling wing in his ecstasy, then off, forth on swing, as a skate's heel sweeps smooth on a bow bend, the hurl and gliding rebuffed the big wind. My heart in hiding stirred for a bird, the achiever of, the mastery of the thing. Brute beauty and valor and act, O air, pride, plume, here buckle, and the fire that breaks from thee then, a billion times told lovelier, more dangerous, O my chevalier. No wonder of it, sheer plod makes plough down sillion shine, and blue bleak embers, ah, my dear, fall, gall themselves, and gash gold vermilion.